This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Coming up in this program, leading scientist Dr. David Karoly says record heat and fires in Australia are a warning to the world. But we are not alone in the big change. Insects may adapt or die faster than humans, as told by the Bug Guy, University of Maryland's Dr. Michael Raup. Then Stephen Davis explains why climate solutions advanced just 9 years ago are no longer possible. A new report says existing technology is not enough to stem the climate tide. So now what? Welcome to another full load from Radio EcoShock. You've heard about extreme heat and fires in Australia at the start of 2013. Is it climate change? We go now to one of that country's leading climate experts, Dr. David J. Karoly. He's been a lead IPCC author and advises the Australian government through the Climate Change Authority. After a stint teaching meteorology at the University of Oklahoma, Karoly is now at the School of Earth Sciences, University of Melbourne. Dr. Karoly, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Welcome to you too, and I'm happy to be here.
It's ironic. Just as I wrote you about the relative quiet in Australia, your country went into a record-smashing heat wave. How does this Australian summer stack up?
Well, we're still right in the middle of the summer, so we can't really look back at how hot it is over the whole summer relative to previous years. But certainly we've already set a number of countrywide records for extreme high temperatures. Record high temperatures have been set, record all-time temperatures have been set in Sydney and Canberra last week. Record high temperatures for the average maximum temperature averaged across the whole of the country. And records for the extent and duration of the heat wave that's really now lasted for more than 2 weeks. But, you know, one of the interesting things when we look at, say, high temperatures, both in Australia and in many other countries, Australia is roughly the size of the United States or roughly the same area as Canada. And often you'll find that it's hot in one part of the country, but cooler in the opposite part of the country. So it might be, you know, hot on the west coast and cool on the east coast, or vice versa. The interesting thing about this heat wave is that it's extended across a large part of the country. And we've had the new area average record maximum temperature. And what we've had is, in fact, 6 days in a row where the record area average maximum temperature was above 39 degrees Celsius. So if we convert that into Fahrenheit, that's about 102 Fahrenheit averaged across the whole of the area of Australia, and Australia exceeded that for 6 days in a row. So the heatwave was widespread and long-lasting.
Well, I want to dig deeper into that, but first I just want to ask you a quick question. You taught meteorology at the University of Oklahoma. That's a state known for oil and maybe climate denial, at least in its leadership. Did you experience resistance there?
You're absolutely right. I was a professor at the University of Oklahoma in the Department of Meteorology for 5 years, from 2003 to 2007. And I was recruited to, if you like, strengthen the climate science expertise in that department. I found that there was, a wide range of opinions on climate science and climate change. Obviously, Oklahoma is the middle of the United States, a relatively conservative state. Many of the people were very much aware of changes in climate. Oklahoma has experienced heat waves and drought in many of the years recently. And for the last two summers in the United States has experienced record high temperatures and very low rainfall. So the people in Oklahoma were already experiencing, or have been experiencing high temperatures and impacts of climate change as well as climate variability. So they were very much aware of what was going on. Their understanding of the causes or their interpretation of the causes varied depending on who you talk to. The conservative senator from Oklahoma, Senator Inhofe, has said repeatedly that global warming is the greatest scientific hoax ever perpetrated on the American public. So he's obviously a climate change denier. But equally, the president of the university and many other people in Oklahoma were keen to support both greater research and communication on the impacts of climate change, on the link between human activity and increasing greenhouse gases on climate change around the world, and particularly preparation for the increasing temperatures and the impacts of climate change in North America.
Well, I'm glad you clarified that, because it always seems strange when a place that's hit so hard still has some people resisting it at the top. Well, getting back to Australia, what is the Climate Commission? And please tell us about the recent report, Off the Charts, Extreme Australian Summer Heat.
The Climate Commission is an independent body established by the Australian government now 3 years ago to enhance or improve the communication of climate science and climate change information, including the impacts of climate change, to the Australian public. So it undertakes to prepare reports and have community information sessions in cities and regional centres all around Australia on climate variability, on climate change, and on the impacts of climate change, both currently and projected into the future. I'm a member of the science advisory panel to the Climate Commission. I'm not actually a climate commissioner. There are six members of the Climate Commission who have a range of backgrounds from climate science, from the impacts of climate change, from the business sector, and from, if you like, the communications sector. One of the things that the Climate Commission decided to do, given the heat wave, was rapidly prepare a short report looking at both the current heatwave in Australia and the associated bushfires or wildfires that are occurring in many parts of Australia at the current time, look at explaining those in terms of the typical summertime high temperatures and wildfire occurrence in Australia, and why when we look at long-term data records for more than 100 years, we can see clear increasing trends in high temperatures and increasing trends in the weather conditions associated with these extreme wildfires, and that those are likely due to human-caused climate change. So the Climate Commission report was released just over a week ago, and it has received a lot of attention both in the media and from community groups because it tries to provide the best scientific information about what is going on, and was supported with data from the National Weather Service in Australia called the Bureau of Meteorology and other information from long-term weather and climate records.
Well, I'm going to put a link to that report in my blog at ecoshock.info so people can give it a good look. You know, this reminds me, a couple of years ago, Australia suffered through a massive drought, especially in the Murray-Darling region, where farmers were stressed out. Some gave up entirely. It was very much like the big 2012 drought in America. Have Australian farmers recovered from that blow?
In many areas, yes, farmers have recovered. You're absolutely right. The period from 1997 to 2010 in Australia was a record low rainfall for much of eastern and southern Australia, and a very long-term low rainfall, which has been linked to human-caused climate change as well, although the exact extent of the climate change influence versus natural variability is still uncertain. But it was a record long-term drought. Farmers, as you said, had to adapt to that. And as you said, a number of farmers changed their operations or gave up completely. The really interesting thing is that Australia, for a long time, has been described as a land of droughts and flooding rains because of the very strong influence of natural climate variability associated with the El Niño and La Niña events that influence the west coast of North America, but they very much have an influence in eastern Australia. In 2010 through 2012, we had two La Niña events, one after the other. La Niña events is when there's cold ocean temperatures in the equatorial Pacific Ocean. They contribute to dry conditions in the central southern part of the United States. So the dry conditions or drought in 2010 to 2012 in Oklahoma and Texas is likely associated with these La Nina sea surface temperatures in the Pacific, but they lead to very wet conditions in Australia. And for the last 2 years, from 2010 to 2012, well, until the middle of 2012, we had very wet, both summer and winter conditions in much of Australia. And that's allowed the farmers to recover, and we've had very good conditions. In fact, very lush pastures, very good crop growth and recovery of many of the reservoirs to nearly full catchments in many areas of Australia associated with 2 years of rainfall. However, if we look at the longer-term records, there is, in fact, still, if you like, long-term rainfall deficit, even though we've had two very good years, associated with the 13 years of low rainfall from 1997 to 2010. And we switched in the middle of 2012, or the last third of 2012, to low rainfall again in much of southern and eastern Australia. There was a precursor to these record heat waves and wildfire conditions in much of southern and eastern Australia.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm your host, Alex Smith, with our guest, Dr. David Karoly, one of Australia's leading climate experts. David, I asked you about the previous lull in the Australian heat and after those fires of 2009, partly because I'm afraid climate change will go into a quiet period, perhaps due to natural cycles, and then pop out worse a few years later. I note the UK Met Office has reduced its prediction slightly for the next few years. Do scientists worry that the public will just go to sleep if we don't see these great heat waves and not do anything?
You're absolutely right that climate change is superimposed on the natural variability of the climate system. And one of the difficult things in communication about climate change is to try to present clearly that even with large variations in rainfall or temperatures, that climate change doesn't mean record high temperatures every year, but that if we look at the longer term records, in effect, when we look at the climate, the 5 or 10 year averages, it's only on those sorts of timescales that we can see clearer trends in climate. And so, yes, climate scientists are concerned about the most effective communication and that we need to ensure that the public and particularly policymakers are aware that one wet year or one cool year doesn't mean that climate change has disappeared or gone away. That in fact we need to look at large areas across the globe and longer term records to see the influence of human activity and increasing greenhouse gases on the climate system. And when we do that, we can see very clear signals when we look at records of, say, Arctic ice extent in summer. We see long-term decreasing trends. When we look at heat content in the upper layers of the ocean, we see long-term warming trends. And when we look at global average temperatures, not just in an individual year, but 5 or 10 year averages, we see long-term warming trends. And the message that the climate is no longer warming is in fact completely wrong. When we look at the current decade, it is warmer than the previous decade, which was warmer than the previous decade. When we look at surface temperatures, when we look at year-to-year variations, yes, there is large natural variability. But when we look at the climate, we see long-term warming trends.
Well, to an outside observer, David, Australia seems a bit schizophrenic. We hear progressive talk from top politicians, and at least they admit there is climate change. And at the same time, the federal and state governments, some of them are going full speed ahead to increase the country's coal exports, maybe doubling sales to China or India. And now Australians are being hit over the head with the results. Is there any chance the coal industry can be reined in before we do reach catastrophic changes?
First of all, the Australian government has introduced a price on carbon dioxide emissions associated with industrial activity in Australia. It's introduced a carbon pricing mechanism, as it's described, as a lead-in to a full Australian greenhouse gas emissions trading scheme linked to the European Union's emissions trading scheme for carbon dioxide emissions. The price on carbon dioxide is $26 a tonne of emissions currently, and that increases every year associated with inflation, and then goes to a full emissions trading scheme in 2015. So Australia has set a price on carbon, which is a step in the right direction. The price is too low at present to lead to major emission reductions, but Australia has set a target for 5% emission reductions below 2000 levels by 2020, and that is an important step. In fact, the really interesting thing is that the price on carbon and increases in electricity prices are leading to reductions in electricity consumption from burning fossil fuels, and in fact reductions in emissions associated with electricity generation in Australia over the last 2 years. So both of those things are really good moves. On the other hand, Australia is, or should I say, Australian governments at the federal and state level are seeking to export coal and natural gas as quickly as possible and expand the exports of those. And I've likened that to being a drug dealer to try to reduce your own adverse impacts by not consuming yourself or reducing your own consumptions, but to sell this harmful product to other users overseas so that you make money from selling this harmful product. Unfortunately, it's even worse than being a drug dealer, because with drugs and you sell them to someone else, you don't actually get the adverse impacts. For Australia, selling coal overseas, Australia still receives the adverse impacts from a warming climate due to emissions of Australian coal when it's burnt in Asian countries or other countries around the world. It's a schizophrenic attitude. I have lobbied against that in Australia. I have written to the electricity generators in Australia and have recently signed a public letter advocating that there should be no increase in coal exports in Australia.
You know, those frightening scenes of Australia fires and Tasmania burning, is that something that is just happening in Australia? I mean, there's always been fires there, even from the times of the Aboriginal peoples. Or is that something that we should be expecting in the Americas or Eurasia as well?
It is certainly the case that in specific susceptible parts of the world, there have been an increase in wildfire occurrence. It's associated with the regions of the world that we would typically describe as having a Mediterranean climate, which often means relatively low rainfall in summer and relatively high temperatures. So obviously areas around the Mediterranean, but there are also areas in the United States and similar parts of the world where there's been marked increase in fire frequency and area burnt. It's also true that in Canada, there have been increases in forest fires, not every year, but in drier years, particularly in summer, increases in the area burnt by fires that have been clearly linked to human-caused climate change, leading to hotter temperatures in summer and therefore increased risk of wildfire in dry years. So not every year, but an increased frequency and area burnt of wildfires in Canada.
And when it comes to the climate, what are you telling Australians they should expect in the next 50 years if we just keep going the way we're going?
Unfortunately, Australia is one of the developed countries, if not the developed country, that experiences the worst of the adverse impacts of climate change. So in 50 years' time, we're looking at marked increases in Australian temperatures, likely of the order of 2 to 3 degrees. Dramatic increases in the frequency of extreme high temperatures and the frequency of extreme wildfire conditions. In parts of Australia, increases in rainfall, particularly in northern Australia and some parts with summertime rainfall. Reductions in rainfall, particularly in wintertime, in much of southern Australia. And given that the wintertime rainfall is what replenishes many of the reservoirs, decreases in water resources, particularly for irrigation in many parts of southern and eastern Australia. Decreases in snow cover, in the alpine areas in Australia, affecting many ecosystems, increasing in ocean temperatures, leading to adverse impacts on marine ecosystems, as well as increases in acidity in the oceans, again leading to adverse impacts on ocean ecosystems, major increases in frequency of bleaching in coral reefs, particularly in northeastern Australia, the Great Barrier Reef, but also in coral reefs in Western Australia, and likely major adverse impacts and major decline in coral reef systems, major declines in the alpine ecosystems in northern Australia, and in 50 years, while most people are surprised that there is already a skiing industry in Australia, that skiing industry will have disappeared in Australia, and many of the alpine ecosystems will be heading towards extinction because of the absence of long-term snow cover in the wintertime. So a lot of really adverse impacts in Australia. There are one or two beneficial impacts. There will be warmer temperatures in the far south of Australia, in the state of Tasmania, which will likely lead to increases in the growing season and increases in agricultural productivity in many parts of Tasmania. But that's about the only area that appears to get some beneficial impacts from climate change in 50 years' time, unless you consider that having the seaside property moving inland, if you're already maybe a kilometre from the coast, that that's a beneficial impact. But I think many of the people in the coastal fringe would argue that that's probably not a beneficial impact to having sea level rise and storm surges affecting further inland.
Well, this is going to change the whole continent from something since the settlers arrived into something completely different. Is there anything else you'd like to leave with our listeners for both Australia and the world?
I think maybe that what I've described for Australia is really like a canary in the coal mine. As I said, Australia is the developed country that is suffering most from the adverse impacts of climate change. But many of the same sorts of impacts will be happening or are already happening in many different countries around the world. And so the sorts of impacts that I've described are affecting the United States, are affecting many other mid-latitude countries around the world and many of the tropical countries as well. Canada is obviously a rather cooler country in many times of the year than Australia, but it will also be suffering from these increases in hot extremes in summer, as well as impact from increases in sea level rise and reductions in snow cover and impacts like that. So Australia should be seen as just an early example of many of the adverse impacts of climate change, and therefore an indicator that action on climate change is critical to slow down warming of the climate system and to try to meet the globally agreed target of limiting warming to only 2 degrees above pre-industrial levels.
Well, thank you. I'm Alex Smith. You've just heard from Dr. David Karoly, the Australian climate expert. You can find more links to the recent report Off the Charts and more in my show blog at ecoshock.info. David, thank you so much for sharing your time with us.
You're welcome, Alec.
Radio EcoShock.
Still coming up, Stephen Davis from the University of California on the rapid death of wedge theory. But first, television entertains us with weird weather striking all over the world as the planet warms. We see people coping with drought, flooded out, burned out, or blown away, but it's all about us. We're not alone here. The insects are also responding to climate change. Here to explain is the bug guy, University of Maryland entomologist Dr. Michael J. Rope. Michael, thank you for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
It's my pleasure to be here today, Alex.
You've given lectures about insects and climate change. How does the audience react?
Well, on some quarters, I think they're a little bit skeptical, but I think the folks that are actually out there in the field dealing with bugs understand that it's a warming world, and the bugs are starting earlier, they're going longer, and they're doing some things we've never seen before.
Well, what are some of the big bug stories as the world warms?
Well, really, I think it boils down to three major things. Number one, insects and mites are normally constrained in temperate climates like North America by colder temperatures. So as the world warms, what we might expect to see, what we are actually seeing already here in North America, is expansion of the range of insects into higher latitudes and altitudes. In other words, they're moving further north, and they're also moving higher in mountains than they ever have before. That's point number one. Point number two is that as the season advances, and there was a piece, just last week in one of the major news sources that talked about the fact that plants may be blooming anywhere from a month to perhaps 6 weeks earlier than they had just a century and a half ago. So this also means that insects will begin to be active much earlier in the season, and as the warm temperatures linger much later into the season. That's point number two. And point number three is that many of our insects are what we call multivoltine. What this means is they can complete several generations every year. Certain insects, things like the gypsy moth, for example, have but one generation a year. We call those univoltine. But for many smaller insects and some of our important pests, things like mosquitoes and spider mites and leaf beetles, they may complete several generations a year. And as the world warms, they're simply going to have more generations a year. And that means a lot more bugs hanging around. So I think things are changing in several important ways.
And how does heat affect the bugs? If it's really a lot hotter, what happens for them?
Well, fundamentally, insects have what we call a developmental threshold. In other words, at certain low temperatures, the bugs in Vancouver right now are doing nothing but sitting there being cold because the temperatures are below their developmental threshold. But as the temperatures increase, and oftentimes somewhere about perhaps around 10 degrees or 15 degrees Celsius, they'll actually begin to develop. In other words, their physiological processes will kick in, and there's a very simple relationship between temperature and development in insect, and it's simple. The hotter it is, the faster they develop. This will increase to a certain point, however, somewhere around perhaps 30 or 35 degrees will reach an upper threshold for those insects, and continued exposure to those temperatures will, of course, be lethal. But that window in between, it simply means that the warmer it is, the faster the bug develops. This simply means they can complete more generations in less time.
And 30 and 35, you're talking about centigrade, so that'd be over 100 Fahrenheit for the American listener. You know, other places, poor old England, for example, is being hit with extreme rainfall events. The wet weather hardly stops, except when it drops loads of snow instead. How does that change in the hydrology cycle, the water world? How does that affect the insects?
Well, in terms of their development, of course, drought is critically important. Insects, like all other organisms, have to have water. It's a critical element. So the water-dwelling insects, the ones that depend on water, things like our mayflies and damselflies, of course, when we go through periods of drought, this is critical to those particular organisms. But the thing, that's really important here is many of our serious disease vectors, and now I'm talking about things like mosquitoes, also depend on water. So water cycles will affect the ability of insects to breed, of course, particularly those species that are aquatic. But by and large, our terrestrial insects are getting enough water through the plants they feed on, through dew and moisture that they imbibe directly, that they're probably going to be okay. Drought would have to be severe. There's a more indirect role here, Alex. The other piece of this puzzle, weather cycle, the moisture cycle, is that plants depend very heavily, of course, on water because it's one of the resource materials in that process of photosynthesis, CO2 plus H2O. So without water, plants simply can't do their job of photosynthesis. What this means is that when we have water shortages, droughted, for example, that this will stress plants, and stress can predispose plants to attack by many different kinds of insects, some of our most egregious borers, things like that Asian longhorn beetle and the mountain pine beetle and the emerald ash borer will all be favored by periods of drought. So there is a relationship with water, But back to our point here, this business about climate change and global warming really, really are going to shift the way bugs and plants do their business over the next, or for the foreseeable future, I think.
Well, you mentioned mosquitoes and disease, and I think some Americans are going to be shocked when a tropical disease like dengue fever shows up more and more. It's already in Florida and Texas, and we got the West Nile virus has spread right across Canada. Do you see that happening more and more, and is there anything we could do about it?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was a spectacular year here for West Nile in the lower 48, and even up in your neck of the woods, we saw record numbers earlier in the season. Again, I think this is linked in part to the fact that, for example, when temperatures are, let's say, somewhere in that ballpark of perhaps something like 70 degrees, I'm going to switch back to Fahrenheit now, 70 degrees Fahrenheit, it might take a mosquito something like 14 days to go from egg to adult. But that same mosquito, when it's 90 degrees out, is going to only require 7 days to go through the same process. So this means in the same unit of time at that warmer temperature, we can have twice as many generations. And this is part of the problem with things like West Nile. You up the generation, you speed up these generations, it simply means more insects, more mosquitoes biting, and more potential to transmit that West Nile virus from a bird to a horse or a human being. So this is really the problem we see. And absolutely, here on the East Coast back in the day, in warmer periods of time, we had diseases like malaria as far north as Baltimore and Philadelphia. So with a warming world, we could expect to see some of these more tropical diseases actually spread to cooler parts of the nation, no question.
It sounds like there's almost a revolution happening in the insect world.
It's an evolution revolution. We've been here before with these things. I think what some people don't appreciate, perhaps, is the world has been through several changes of these warming and cooling cycles. Heck, if we went back a mere 15,000 years ago right now, I'd be sitting under a glacier that was 1,000 feet deep during the last ice age. And, hey, look at the place now. It's warm. We're growing crepe myrtles in Maryland. Everything looks wonderful. So old Mother Earth has been through these kinds of cycles before, but we certainly are in a warming cycle right now, no question.
Well, right. Scientists studying leaf fossils found greatly increased signs of insect damage during the last great global warming event. That was around 56 million years ago. I wonder if we could see maybe a similar bug explosion in the next 100 years.
Well, it's really hard to know. One thing we know for sure, Alex, is that we're seeing a penetration of many of the southern species. We have particularly nasty group of insects, which we classify as the scale insects. And during the past decade here in Maryland, I've witnessed scales, wax scales, which are very common to places like Florida and Texas, are actually overwintering now in places like Maryland. The cottony cushion scale, which is a ravages things like citrus, actually managed to survive a Maryland winter here for the past two or three seasons. So we're seeing this movement of the southern pests further north, and I think absolutely the same thing will happen. Some of the pests that exist now in our temperate forests in the mid-Atlantic states, as things warm, we expect those to move further north as well. So it's kind of a shifting scheme that we're seeing here. Everybody's moving further north. The mountain pine beetle, which has caused such devastation to the lodgepole pines out in the Rockies now, is well up in your neck of the woods. It's actually moved much, much further north, and it's moving up the mountainsides and attacking whole new sections of forest that were inaccessible before. So it's a changing world right now.
This is Radio EcoShock with the bug guy, Dr. Michael J. Rope from the University of Maryland. We are talking about the impacts of climate change on the insect world. Well, Mike, most of human talk is about ourselves. Can you tell us about some of the insects changing as climate changes that we don't interact with?
There's a number of other potentially beneficial things. There's some discussion that maybe some of our predatory insects, these would be things like ladybird beetles perhaps, or predaceous flies, actually have the ability to take advantage of a warming day a little bit quicker than their sluggish herbivorous prey, that perhaps the balance could tip in their favor. So this is still an issue that's being hotly debated on the part of the scientists. And we're not really sure how all of this will play out, whether the predators will get the upper hand here and mainly womp on those herbivores, the plant eaters, and keep their populations down, or whether perhaps it'll switch over the other way and the herbivores will get the upper hand and perhaps cause more damage to our plants, as you alluded to. You're absolutely right. The fossil record showed in the warming world that the plants actually sustained more herbivory at the last period of warming. It's a great experiment, a grand experiment underway right now, of which we're the guys, I think, unfortunately, pulling the levers. And it's just going to be very interesting to see how the whole thing plays out.
Could increasing insect populations affect greenhouse gas emissions, or is that a silly question?
No, I think it's a fair question. I don't think anybody really knows for sure. I mean, higher populations of any organism that respires is going to increase levels of CO2, atmospheric CO2. But, kind of on the other side of this, I think as temperatures warm, and actually plants may be the benefactors in this, I think there have been some studies that actually show that plants may be able to remove greater amounts of CO2 at warmer temperatures. And primary production, I think, has been linked to higher CO2 levels in some cases. So this could actually be of some benefit from the plant part. So as I said, I think nobody really knows for sure which way this whole balance is going to tip. It's kind of a crazy world out there right now.
Indeed. Well, Michael Rope, is there a particular type of insect that will thrive as climate change develops, or are there other particular types that will be in trouble just like us?
One of the things I'm most concerned with is there's a delicate balance between humidity and rainfall and temperature. So for certain regions of the world, for places where we have, let's say, cloud forests, tropical cloud forests are in the same pickle, I think. As the world warms, basically that balance that creates a cloud forest will actually change. So in montane regions, one of the factors that could influence the entire biota is the changing in elevation of the cloud forest. Well, mountains are only so high, and if the rate of change is too quick, what I'm concerned with is those unique plants that dwell in cloud forests may simply disappear as the cloud forests disappear. And this, in turn, wouldn't extirpate just one or two species. This will take away entire biota. So, again, these are the kind of harbingers, I think, that we need to be concerned with. What is climate change going to mean for these delicate communities that depend on relationships between rainfall and temperature to create those unique conditions? Those are the ones I'm really worried about.
Right. We had some interesting studies here in British Columbia of what's going on in the very tops of the trees of the rainforest, and they found insects that had never been cataloged before. They found that that was where the richest life was going on. So when those great rainforests are brought down by logging or by fires or by drought, then a huge amount of insects could be lost.
Yeah, absolutely. We've only begun to scratch the surface of what's known in our rainforest communities. The one you mentioned, of course, our tropical rainforests are vast unknown territories and rich biotically. I mean, we haven't even begun to imagine what kind of medicinal drugs, what kind of products could be useful for humankind as well as for the entire biosphere in these forests, and the possibility that these things might disappear before we find out actually what comprises these wonderful communities is of deep concern, I think, to conservationists and ecologists everywhere.
Well, where bugs are in trouble and maybe something that we love, like a butterfly, should we interfere, like sort of geoengineering in the sense of just driving some butterflies to a new home?
The bugs, by and large, are pretty good at finding the new habitat as long as we preserve some of this. Again, I think the communities I worry the most about are these threatened communities where we have endemic species of plants that are in ever-shrinking geographic regions and habitats that are now disappearing, our coastal communities and some of our remnant forests. These are the guys I think we have to worry about preserving. Fortunately for many of these invertebrates, their habitat requirements aren't nearly as vast as something like large cats or polar bears. So the bugs may have a little edge up on this one, Alex.
I think if we look into the human psyche, we find out that people are afraid of insects generally. And one of the things they ask themselves is there a chance insects will just take over the world?
Well, they should get over it, Alex. Insects already have taken over the world. So this is just a little slice of reality here. The bugs have been here for 320 million years, more or less. And I would wager that 320 million years after we have gone the way of the dodo, there'll still be a little silverfish running around out there. But people can take solace in this because you share somewhat on the order of about 80% of your genes with an insect. So sometime in the distant future, there will be just a little part of you running around. I'm saying this kind of tongue-in-cheek, but insects really are fascinating marvels of evolution, and they've been able to survive many of the cataclysmic events that have extirpated life, many other kinds of life forms. So I think they're going to hang in pretty well. One of the things we're really concerned with right now, Alex, is the fundamental mismatch that climate change may wrought on the relationship between flowering plants and their pollinators. Both plants and insects are cold-blooded, so to speak. In other words, they depend on certain environmental cues, probably the foremost of which is temperature, to regulate their biologies, to synchronize their life cycles. So one of the concerns we have right now is that if plants, let's say, are listening to temperature as the primary cue for flowering and then pollination and producing fruit, and perhaps if insects are listening to a slightly different time regulator, let's say something like day length, as temperature changes, we might see a earlier appearance of flowering and blossoming of plants. But if the insects are being guided by day length, which is not changing, we may wind up with a catastrophic mismatch between the flowering times of plants and the actual activity time of insects. So one of our big concerns right now with climate change and global warming is this intimate relationship that pollinators have with their plants may actually suffer due to a shift in temperatures that basically derails this link between insect activity, pollinator activity, and the appearance of flowers in their hosts.
Right. We saw even the early appearance of flowers now compared to the time of 200 years ago. A recent paper came out about that, about Walden Pond and all that. And we've also got the problem of bees. People are very concerned about bees, and we think that's related to a certain pesticide. What's your take on the bee problem?
Yeah, absolutely. Our honeybee, our good friend that we depend on so heavily to pollinate so many of our agricultural crops, have really struggled over the past years. They've been under an enormous pressure, beginning with the varroa mites, but also with certain viruses, certain pathogens, fungi, bacteria that are attacking them. There's concern now that some of the residual pesticides, systemic pesticides that have been used in agricultural production, may actually be toxic to the bees and disrupting their ability to pollinate. So unfortunately, our bees have really suffered over the past several years, over the past decade, let's say. But there's kind of good news here. The colony collapse disorder, which was so rampant 5 years ago, actually has been declining in many regions of the country over the past 2 or 3 years. So perhaps we've turned a corner on this colony collapse disorder. We certainly hope so. But again, what climate change means for our honeybees, will they be able to advance their season and respond to the early blossoming of flowers? And even more importantly, remember now, the honeybee is not native to North America. The guys that have been hauling the freight here for the past millions of years are actually the native pollinators, our little solitary bees, our bumblebees. And nobody really knows for sure what climate change and this advance in the season, the advance of flowers, is going to mean for this synchrony that has to take place for our flowering trees and shrubs. So it's still a big question mark and one that many scientists are concerned with.
Well, I guess we'll find out all that if our food prices start going up.
Absolutely. No question there.
We've been talking with the bug guy, as seen on TV, Dr. Michael J. Raup from the University of Maryland Extension Program. I want to add an alert for all our gardener listeners. Be sure and watch Michael Raup's YouTube videos on pest control, including his useful and fun CSI garden pests. I'll post links to all that in my blog at ecoshock.info. One of Mike's books is 26 Things That Bug Me. And check out Mike's weekly insect update at bugoftheweek.com. Thank you so much, Michael.
It's been a pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Be part of the program. Get the voices of cutting-edge science and activism widely heard. Find out how you can help us at our website, ecoshock.org. Way back in 2004, two Princeton scientists, Stephen Pakula and Robert Sokolow, wrote in the journal Science, and I quote, "Humanity can solve the carbon and climate problem in the first half of this century simply by scaling up what we already know how to do." They broke up the problem of greenhouse gas emissions into sections they famously called wedges. Each represented a sector of pollution with ways to scale that back over 50 years. But we didn't do much of anything except increase emissions. A new article published in the journal Environmental Research Letters suggests we may have lost that chance with just those 8 years of delay. Let's dig into that deeper with one of the authors of the new assessment, Dr. Stephen J. Davis. He's an assistant professor in the Department of Earth System Science at the University of California, Irvine. Stephen, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
Well, Steve, can you start by explaining the original idea and hope behind the wedges?
Sure. So when the guys at Princeton, Robert Sokolow and Steve Pakula, wrote the paper, they were reacting to sort of the dominant line in the Bush administration at the time, which was climate change is such a daunting problem that we really have no way to tackle it. And so they wanted to emphasize that we actually had a lot of tools that we could start down the path of mitigating climate change. And so they took what was a business-as-usual trajectory of emissions that were expected it to be in the future, which would rise over time, and they said if we could just create deploy technologies that would decrease those emissions such that we could hold our emissions constant for 50 years and then decrease those emissions afterwards, after 50 years, by a couple percent a year, that we could hold the atmospheric levels of CO2 to 500 ppm. Which at the time was what climate scientists were saying would avoid the worst climate impacts.
Well, that raises a lot of questions, but let's suppose we could manage to stop increasing CO2 emissions every year. We just stay at our current levels. What happens?
When they originally wrote the paper in 2004, they calculated that it would take about 7 of these wedges. And so the wedge unit is defined as growing from 0 emissions avoided to 1 billion tons of carbon avoided over the course of 50 years, 1 billion tons a year, so that the cumulative amount of emissions avoided by a single wedge is about 25 billion tons. It is 25 billion tons. And they said 7 of these could reduce the business-as-usual growth pattern and hold it constant. And so by holding it constant, like I said, they said we could stay under 500 ppm. The problem is that since 2004, our emissions have increased, and moreover, they've accelerated, the growth rate has accelerated, such that we actually need more than 7 wedges now just to stabilize emissions, at least 9 and perhaps more, and we can get into that a little more. But the new elevated level of annual emissions means that if you held today's emissions constant for 50 years, you'd be right at 2 degrees of warming and over 500 ppm before you even started any sort of reduction in emissions.
Wow. Well, it seems we're on our way to accomplishing one of the Princeton wedges. They called for doubling fuel efficiency in cars from 30 miles per gallon to 60, and that's just shy of 4 liters per 100 kilometers for our European listeners. So what wedges fell apart so badly that our emissions keep increasing every year?
Well, I mean, the one that people really point at is that the developing world, and particularly places like China and India, have really been growing like gangbusters, and they've been doing that using really carbon-intensive sources of energy like coal. And so this is why emissions have grown and why the growth rate has accelerated, as I mentioned.
Well, I've got to ask the simple questions first. Why can't we make the original 7 wedges bigger?
Sure. Well, you know, the wedge, as they defined it, was sort of a unit, like a meter or a gallon or a liter. as you said a minute ago. And so really what we've done in the new paper is to calculate the new number of wedges that you would need to offset the problem. It's not that you have to stop with one wedge of a certain technology. You could have two or three, but the wedge is a unit now that's a handy one for referring to the size of the challenge.
And I'm presuming your team tried to figure out what would prevent horrible climate change, and I realize those answers are many and huge, but why don't we start with what we need to just stabilize at our current emission levels?
Sure. So, you know, we said that nine wedges of emissions would be able to avoid growth in emissions and hold our emissions constant right now. And we didn't really list out specific ideas in this paper. This was more revisiting the idea of whether a wedge concept was useful to solve the problem, as the original paper said. So, you know, in the original paper, they had 15 different options of wedges, and so we could go through some of those if you're interested, but, you know, it would take nine of those now to actually just stabilize emissions.
Here's a big question. Can we save ourselves from horrible climate change using existing technology?
Well, so there's a lot packed into that phrase, existing technology. I mean, we show in the paper that if you, instead of just stabilizing emissions at current levels, if you actually start deploying enough wedges to reduce those emissions before 50 years, you can avoid 2 degrees of warming. It's still physically possible to do that. The question then becomes whether you have to come up with new technologies to produce energy without emitting CO2, or if, as Pakala and Sokolo originally suggested, we've got everything we need on the shelf. And so this has been a big debate, and it's been back and forth whether what exactly they meant by current technologies. Of course, everyone knows we have solar photovoltaic panels and wind turbines and nuclear plants, and we know that those things are relatively low carbon sources of energy. So on the one hand, we can say, sure, we could build millions of those literally in order to offset the growth of emissions, and we'd solve the problem. But the problem comes, and they didn't really get into this in the original paper, that there's a lot of cost associated with that. And right now, we can't afford to do that in terms of it wouldn't be competitive with fossil fuels, and no one's willing to take the brunt of the cost of that sort of build-out. And we're doing our best to incentivize with subsidies and those sorts of things some of the deployment of these technologies, but to do it at the scale that we would need to in order to offset all of the energy that we're getting from fossil fuels would just not be affordable. And so we make a case in the new paper that the way to get to a real solution to the problem would be to really innovate and try to drive the cost of those technologies down and make a concerted effort to deploy as many as you can in the near term.
Well, you know, and I guess we're getting a little off the topic of science here, but that what you just said suggests to me that maybe it's a problem with our economic system. If we have an economic system that says, well, it just doesn't pay to save the climate, maybe that's at the root of the problem.
I think that's right. I've used the metaphor in the past of a diet. And so if you want to lose some weight, you know that you need to stop eating so many cookies, for instance. And so in this metaphor, fossil fuels are the cookies. They're very tempting because they're cheap and we know how to work with them. They're just not as attractive as the more expensive and less familiar technologies of renewable energies and advanced nuclear and these sorts of things. So we're really at a situation where we need to walk away from the cookie jar and start eating more salad, but it's not an attractive thing to do at this point. And so really the challenge for scientists and engineers and the political system as well is to figure out how to make those fossil fuels less attractive and make the alternatives, the salad, the renewable energies, more attractive. And really it comes down to economics.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Our guest is Stephen J. Davis from the Department of Earth System Science at the University of California. We're looking at whether solutions to climate change have slipped beyond our grasp in just the last 8 years of delaying action. Well, we just talked a little bit about the economy. You know, some of our listeners, indeed a few of our scientific guests, suggest a very different solution. If it's impossible to keep a safe climate living as we do, maybe the system has to collapse. Should we even try to keep this vision of an energy-hungry civilization going?
It's a fair question, and one of my co-authors, Marty Hofford, has talked a little bit about this, that we're in a clash between economics and physics, really, and that if you look at modern capitalist societies, the idea of extending exponential growth indefinitely is really out of step with what we know about the limits of energy and physics in this planet and this universe. We can't simply keep growing indefinitely unless you think we can do that without using energy to do so.
Well, Stephen Davis, who else worked on this journal article with you, and how was it reviewed?
My co-authors were three other gentlemen. One is Long Cao, who's now a professor at Zhejiang University in China. He is a great climate modeler and did a lot of the climate runs for us. And then the senior authors on it were Marty Hofford, as I just mentioned, who's a professor at NYU in the physics program there. He's an emeritus, but he's written papers on, seminal papers really, on energy and what needs to happen for energy innovation for a long time. And then my postdoctoral advisor, Ken Caldera, who's a senior scientist at the Carnegie Institution.
And what kind of feedback are you getting to your article? I mean, have you heard from the original Princeton authors?
Sure. And in fact, you know, we all get along very well. I have great respect for Pakala and Sokolow both, and I'm actually working on another article with Rob Sokolow right now. So we've had many exchanges via email about the article. In fact, we're doing some sort of a chat on the Science Magazine website this Thursday with Pakala and I that will be discussing some of these same topics.
Well, frankly, Steve, this seems like good news and bad news. The good news may be that government planners and some Greens assumed we had a relatively easy roadmap out of the climate mess. Now we know that's not true, but of course, that's also the bad news. Do you have any thoughts about what this paper really means for all of us?
Yeah, I mean, I think you just sort of started touching on it in that last comment. What Rob and I have been talking about a lot over email is, what should the target for emissions be? You know, in this paper, we've taken a more aggressive position than that original Wedge paper, and we've said we can't just stabilize emissions for 50 years. We really need to start drawing down emissions now. And so Rob worries that by establishing a more aggressive goal, like phasing out emissions over the next 50 years, which is the alternative we propose, we could become monomaniacal and lose sight of some of the trade-offs, both economic trade-offs and possibly environmental trade-offs, as we try to reach that very difficult goal. And so he thinks that we should follow sort of a more of a middle path, if I understand him correctly. While on the other hand, we argue that if science is telling us that we need to limit warming to 2 degrees, then it seems to me we should set an aspirational goal of what it would take to accomplish that. And even if that's exceedingly daunting and a difficult one, it seems like that our public and our policymakers need to face up to the reality that we're very far off from that goal and see what we can do about it.
Well, I see two problems with the 50-year plan. First of all, it seems like humans will always say, well, if we got 50 years, we don't have to worry about it now. We know that about ourselves. But also, I kind of envisaged, and I know I'm not alone in this, that climate change would happen very slowly over this next century, and we'd see a slight change. But we're seeing big changes already with very low amounts of emissions. Do you think our picture of climate change has also altered and given us more drive to do something?
Sure. I mean, I think you're right that human nature is to react to sort of clear and present danger. And so with extreme weather events like the drought of last summer and Hurricane Sandy, that some of these things have become more salient pictures of what we're in for with climate change. And so that's, on the one hand, terrible that these things are already coming to pass, but on the other hand, it's good that now people can get some picture of what we're in store for, and maybe that'll incentivize us to take the drastic measures necessary to reduce our emissions.
Well, you know, I could see somebody reading your article and coming to the conclusion that it's just plain too late. Your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, and I think you're getting to what Sokolow is worried about, at least, is if we paint a picture as scientists of the solution that is just too daunting that people might give up and walk away. And I suppose I have a better outlook on the nature of humans to face up to a challenge like that and figure out ways to solve the problem. I'm essentially an optimist, and I think that we can develop the technologies that we need to create the energy we use without emitting CO2, and I think we can do it in time to avoid the worst impacts from climate change, but it is an incredibly daunting challenge. And so, you know, there is the possibility that some policymakers will give up on that or look for easier solutions. This is another fear of looking for things like geoengineering, for instance, that can avert some of the warming and the impacts maybe, instead of doing the hard work of actually deploying new energy systems and reducing our emissions.
You've been listening to Stephen J. Davis from the Department of Earth Science at the University of California, Irvine. He's part of a team of scientists who reassessed the famous wedge theory of solving the climate crisis. You can find that article in the journal Environmental Research Letters, and it was published in January 2013. I'll put a link to that paper and a good article by Tim Radford at the Climate News Network in my own blog at ecoshock.info. Steve, thank you so much, even for the bad news.
My pleasure, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you for listening. Lots more next week. Be sure to tune in and act out.